Bushwick, Brooklyn, 2025, November 15th, 8 p.m. We open on a DIY space, Life World, 563 Johnson Avenue. The protagonist is you. You have bought a ticket. You have gone out and you have attended the To the White Sea live show, Cohen's Secrets Unlocked. That's right. We're doing a live show, Ray.
Cohen's Secrets Unlocked. Everyone, we haven't done a live show since Teamwork, and we're back with real deliverables to put on the table. The theme of this live show is Cohen's Secrets
Unlocked.
Unlocked. Unlocked. So we're going to unlock the secrets. We have almost like a hidden world, secrets that run through every single Cohen's feature, and we will be revealing them with a series of mind-melting surprise guests.
Awesome guests.
Multimedia presentations, audience interaction. So this will really be the To the White Sea study group reunion in New York City, November 15th.
In person,
yeah.
Ray, should we do bits on the show?
Just on the show ever?
Or especially at the live show? Like, is it a no bits show or is it a pro bits show?
I feel like this is a pro bits show.
I think we got some bits.
But the secrets are not bits. These are true.
Yes.
These are true secrets.
I was working on a secrets document. I'm not going to reveal what they are just yet. You'll have to come out and see them. But I want to be clear that I had standards. Like, I had real protocol for putting these secrets together. And there were a lot of moments where I was like, does this qualify? Like, does this hit the threshold of a true secret?
Yeah.
And I can think of one case where I was like, nope, I selected it and I deleted it. And
you know, want to tell anyone what that is right now?
It was a piano.
Okay. So quality control is in effect.
What you see is going to be a honed, well-running machine. It's going to be like a, it's not going to be one of those rusted out jalopies that are just putt-putting down the street. This is going to be, it's going to run on solar energy, yeah. but it's going to be at night.
We're
going to be charged up.
We're so excited to do a show at Life World. Our guest, Ian Faria, is going to be helping us produce the show. It's just going to be great. It's going to be such a great night. So if you're in the area or can get to New York City, this will be great.
If you're in the tri-state area, if you're in Philly, make the trip. If you're in New Hampshire, come down. Bernie Sanders will be there.
Yeah, exactly.
No, he's not one of the special guests.
So, Jordan, you were telling me that you've been getting the same question from our listeners again and again.
It's incessant. The DMs, the Discord messages, they need to stop.
Yeah. What are they asking you?
They're asking me, will we be seeing Let's Love?
Let's Love, a theatrical event in New York City right now.
Live on Broadway, the new Ethan Coen series of one-act plays entitled Let's Love.
It's officially on Broadway. It's not an off-Broadway play.
No, it's not off-Broadway. It's on Broadway.
Wow.
And we will be on Broadway. We will be at a Broadway theater.
We have tickets.
We have tickets.
Yeah.
And we will be covering it on the show.
And we're getting into the plays. We're getting into Cohen's theater. We're, in fact, doing a mini-series of Cohen's theatrical works that we're starting on this episode. This is volume one.
That's right. In preparation for Let's Love, Ray and I realized actually just how many Ethan Coen plays there are that we had not seen or read word one from. And it's been a really fun process reading some of them. We're going to kick things off today covering a very special and very, I think, overlooked piece of Coen's work that's like almost unclassifiable.
It's theater, but it's radio theater.
It's a radio play recorded in front of a live audience. It's very dense and
highly experimental.
And it's something that we've also talked about. We've kicked around. But actually, we'll get into that more once we get into it.
This will be a multi-volume miniseries because there's a lot of plays. There's Almost an Evening, which is three plays. There's Offices, which is three plays. There's a one-act Talking Cure. There's a full-length play, Women Are Nothing. Play is a Poem, which I don't know how we're going to find a copy of that. I think we might need to go to that special library in New York City.
And we're going to have to unlock the secrets. It's part of this show is finding these missing texts and pulling them apart, which is part of what I'm excited about.
Tracking down these plays is kind of tricky. In fact, a friend just from Reddit, I posted in the in the Coen Brothers subreddit, does anyone have a copy of Offices?
Because you had gone to the library and it was checked out.
Yeah.
And then he was like, oh, I have that checked out.
So big thanks to TD Gavitt. And also, I want to say, since we have been releasing shows again, there's been a spontaneous occurrence of people donating to the Ko-Fi, which has been great.
Shout out to the Ko-Fi.
Really
thank
been
you.
Heartwarming and surprising and just started happening. So I want to say thank you to Vanessa. Thank you to Benji. Thank you to David. Thank you to Jim. And also just want to shout out just the amazing stuff that's going on our Discord. And anyone who wants to check that out. Jacob, Party Moses, Infinite Jester, and definitely big shout out to Michael Tybersky for joining the Discord.
He's our friend in real life, but somehow it feels like he's realer on the Discord than in real life.
But yeah, it's in this new wave of shows, I feel like just the outreach from people that are listening has been so warm and deep and just like sustaining. So
yeah,
everyone who's getting involved and just helping keep us going, like, it could not appreciate it more. And it's been just cool to see it just kind of happening.
You were saying you think that some of these Ko-Fi donations are from people binging the show, like they're going in order.
Yeah.
Because
we haven't talked about it for a second.
Yeah. And I think we talked about it a little bit earlier on in the show, and we're talking about it now. I mean, we just bought some tickets for the Broadway show. That ain't cheap. No, but we love all the support, be it monetary and direct or loving and
or
intellectual.
Just posting awesome stuff on the Discord.
Like, yeah.
Really deep, incredibly thoughtful stuff that just like creating this parallel conversation to what me and Jordan are having on the show that often goes a lot deeper. Yeah.
I think we got to do another Q&A episode also. Yeah. Yeah, that'd be great.
You want to do a current events thing now, or do you want to go into Sawbones?
Let's do a quick news update. A
news update?
We've gotten some more information on the new Joel Coen film, Jack of Spades.
Oh yeah, Jack of Spades Corner.
Joel Corner.
Joel Corner. Jack of Spades Edition.
Jack of Spades Edition. We have plot summary details. We first noticed this actually on the Carter Burrell website.
Okay. Burrell?
This is Carter Burrell, and I compose the music for both radio dramas you're about to hear.
Our favorite composer, Carter Burwell, as we've been calling him our entire lives. His last name is Burrell?
I've been calling her Crandall. On Carter Burrell's website, he wrote, summary of works in progress. Jack of Spades. Joel Coen will be shooting his next film during the summer of 2025. It's a gothic mystery set in the Wild West of Scotland.
Okay.
That's very exciting news. It makes it sound like it's going to be a Western, but in another country. But not a spaghetti Western.
Are there any gothic Westerns?
You know, it's funny. I almost think of gothic as being the opposite of a Western, because gothic is all about like a spooky house.
Yeah. What about High Plains Drifter?
High Plains Drifter. Does a lot of it take place in a house?
It's just a Western about a ghost.
Yeah.
Spoilers for High Plains Drifter.
Ah, yeah. Yeah. That feels gothic. But gothic Western, you know, it's not your typical combination. Nor is a Western in Scotland, which is cool. We saw pictures of Josh O'Connor looking awesome.
Looking a little bit like Gary Oldman in the Bram Stoker's Dracula.
I think that's an apt comparison.
Yeah.
We know also that Bruno is shooting the film. Sounds like they're just about wrapped shooting.
Big news.
Yeah, this is big news. Bruno Delbonnel, director of photography on Buster Scruggs and Inside Llewyn Davis and The Tragedy of Macbeth, will be returning to work with Joel as the lens man on that film.
You had wanted to pull up the IMDb because it was all self-reporting crew at this point, right?
Is it
still there?
Or? Yeah, there was a sort of like very inchoate moment where none of the crew had been announced, but there was just like people working like in, I don't want to call out any particular department, but like, let's just say it's like office PA or something, was adding themselves, you know, as one does. So for a while, the credits were like Joel Coen and then a bunch of proactive Scots. And I was trying to figure out if I could like triangulate from that like scattering of information who the DP was. But it has been announced that it is Bruno Del Manel, who also shot the new Wes Anderson movie. I sort of feel like he's sort of becoming this cinematographer, like the like most high end replacement, like the most high end substitute for the filmmakers of the recent auteurs. If that makes sense. Like Wes Anderson's worked with Yeoman for forever, but Bruno Del Manel doing the Yeoman's work.
Okay, so moving from Glasgow to NYC, we're going to do a quick municipal moment here.
So we want to say, first of all, this episode is going to come out on Friday. We endorse Zoran Mamdani.
Got the To the White Sea bump.
We To the White Sea endorse Zoran Mamdani. And if you vote on Friday, you will get a special, I have heard, Halloween-themed I Voted sticker. So get out there and vote early.
But the ballot initiatives.
The ballot initiatives.
I always get to go vote. And then at a certain point, I'm texting Jordan from the voting booth being like, what am I supposed to do here? So, Jordan, what should people do?
Okay. This isn't a campaign speech and you can do your own research, folks, but I'm just going to tell you how I'll be voting. Question one is allowing an Olympic sports complex in Essex County on State Forest Preserve land. This has something to do with skiing. I'm voting no on this. No on question one. Question two, fast track affordable housing to build more affordable housing across the city. I've been hearing lots of different things from different people, but the people that I trust are the organizers, the people working with tenants associations. And they tell me that this will take power away from the city council members who know their communities and can negotiate better deals with developers. So I am personally voting no on question two. Question three, simplify review of modest housing and infrastructure projects. This is a long process and it makes sense to shorten the time, but council members are particularly opposed to this one. And again, I will be voting no on question three.
So far we're yes, no, no.
No, no, we're no, no, no.
No, no, no.
We're no on everything. We don't want them to build a ski resort on constitutionally protected.
Yeah.
Questions two through four are about housing, about affordable housing in this city, which on the face of it sounds like a good idea. But in speaking to organizers who really are in on the details of this, it seems like these proposals will take negotiating power away from the people who live in these communities and the council members who know those communities best. Possibly contrary to what you're hearing on Brian Lehrer, I will be voting no on two, three, and four. Question five, create a digital city map to modernize city operations. I think this is a great idea. I see no reason why we have to be using paper maps and why each borough has to be so involved in the topography of their borough with a specific office dedicated to the city map. I think making the city map digital and having it all come through one office makes a lot of sense. So I am voting yes on proposal five. And for question six, move local elections to presidential election years to increase voter participation. I will say that I heard that the outcome of this is that Mamdani could serve for 11 years instead of 8 years. So that does sound compelling. But the overall consensus I'm hearing is that you should vote no on this because it would take the focus away from our local elections, which are already fighting for your attention. And if it all happens on a presidential year, you're just not going to get the info out there. And also those local elections will become extremely expensive because they will have to fight the federal elections for ad slots. So I think we keep it staggered. 2025 is a municipal year, and that's the way it should stay. And that has been the municipal moment.
Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, it is with great pleasure that we introduce to you Theater of the New Ear.
Cohen's Theater Volume 1, Sawbones, a play by Joel and Ethan Cohen, first performed in April 2005.
That's right.
So it's taking us to New York City, 2005, in between Lady Killers and No Country for Old Men.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a project that started with Carter Burrell.
Carter Burrell was invited to perform his scores at the Royal Festival Hall in London. And instead of performing scores that he had already composed and that people had heard before, he decided to ask his friends to write original texts, and then he would create music for them.
Burrell proposed calling his film world friends and trawling for stray script pages to set to music. The first call Mr. Burrell made was to the Coens. I called and asked if they might have a scene sitting around. Instead, they offered to write a sound play from scratch.
I think when he says stray scenes, it's like kind of like, well, I don't want them to write something new.
Yeah.
But you do want them to write something new, but you're also just being like, hey, if it wouldn't be too much trouble, like, do you have anything lying around?
Yeah.
But of course, both the Coen brothers and Charlie Kaufman, who wrote the second play in the evening, ended up writing new material based on the concept that Burrell came up with and the constraints of a text read by actors. So they would have scripts in front of them. They'd be reading off of music stands. There would be live music and Foley as well. What he said was actors at microphones saying lines and a band on stage, says Joel Cohen. And we said, okay, let's write something. When we write something, it generally implies something dramatic. And so it was something dramatic that actors were reading at microphones with a live band on stage, whatever that is.
So that's the prompt. That's the Coen brothers are basically, their friend has asked them to write something that will pop on stage with no costumes, no staging, no scenery. The assignment was, how can we make this interesting? If you're not seeing anything, what would be interesting to us and to an audience? Supposing the drama is these two things intersecting, and then you realize one of them is coming through a television. Building on that, we thought, what if we go to different locations, but the television show is always showing in each one? So that's the consistent thing.
Yes.
So it's basically tying locations together because everyone's watching broadcast TV. So at the same time, two people in completely different spots will have a consistent soundtrack in the background.
They're both watching Sawbones.
Yeah.
And we're listening to Sawbones.
We're cross-cutting between two homes that are watching the same TV show. And so we're hearing the TV show and the dialogue happening in two locations.
Yes. And I don't know what it was like to see this live on stage, but I have to imagine it was at times difficult to understand what exactly was happening, where, like which actors were parts of which diegetic scene in which location.
They got the prompt to write a radio play where there's going to be six actors on stage, a Foley artist and a band.
Yeah.
They chose melodrama to make it pop as a radio play, but then they chose this idea about like diegetic sound bleeding through the TV that makes it almost impossible to understand. I feel like that's the step that makes this one of the densest pieces of writing.
When we had talked about Sawbones before I had listened to it very closely, we always described it as just nonsense. Just like characters all over the place yelling stuff, like overlapping dialogue. Like, I almost thought of it as like, you were talking about that Velvet Underground song.
The Murder Mystery.
The Murder Mystery, which is like...
Or Revolution Number 9.
Or Revolution Number 9. Like, this music concrete, like, random overlapping tracks where you're not supposed to understand what's going on.
It's like experimental music where they're basically like, let's just read two things or let's sing two songs at once. One in each ear, and you're just kind of in the middle of them.
I think this ties into something we were talking about in Ed's episode a couple of episodes ago about how when the Coens do something that seems hard to understand, it's not ambiguous. Like, there actually is, like, there's density there, but there's also specifics. And so listening to this a good number of times, listening to it together, transcribing it, Ray, you went in and
made a script.
You made a script.
Yeah.
Which has all of the dialogue and all of the character names. It actually all really starts to cohere. And it's very clear where everything takes place. And one kind of almost like geographical Carter in the mix of the recording that we have access to did something very clever to help listeners understand what's going on. And that's that he stereo panned the different locations so that you can always tell if you listen closely, where something is happening.
There's no staging, but there is blocking in this radio play in terms of where the voices are assigned in your ears. And then also, you look at pictures of the reading, they set up the actors in a row that corresponds with the voice that you're hearing in your left ear is the actor that's standing on the leftmost part of the stage. And the voice you're hearing in your right ear is right? Is that how it works?
That's right, yeah. And when we play clips from the show, if you're confused, just remember that your left ear
is
TV.
Yeah.
The center channel, or both ears, is Philadelphia. It's a suburban house, or it's a tavern nearby. In your right ear is the Northeast, New England, where John Goodman, as Mr. Nelson, is doing a fire watch and making sure that there isn't any smoke over Lake Winnipesaukee.
Changeless heaven, the plodding days, life alone can be an agony. Well, that's all the news here.
Who is that?
Oh, it's the coward Frank McCready.
No, no, on the telephone.
Oh, darling, I think I'll just go back to Sawbones. Oh, I saw a plume over Winnipesaukee.
Ah, careful, Jerry.
You have to disentangle it, I think, to even see it clearly. It's such a tangled up, overlapping, throws off your sense of place almost constantly by having a imaginary world that's bleeding into two real world locations.
And of course, all of this is fake, but but somehow it becomes real because the television like sort of tricks your brain to being like, okay, that's on TV, but then here's what's really happening. The event is called Theater of the New Ear. The Coen Brothers play is called Sawbones. And then inside that play is a fictional television show called Sawbones as well. What is Sawbones, the TV show?
Very much like the shows the Coens said they grew up watching in the 60s. It's a serialized Western, kind of in the style of Bonanza or F Troop, about the Wild West, focusing on a cattle doctor, like a veterinary doctor.
And that's
played by Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Played by Philip Seymour Hoffman.
And this is Philip Seymour Hoffman. I played Dr. Varlin Smith in Sawbones.
Yeah.
Dr. Varlin Smith. Sawbones is a nickname that somebody came up with when he moved to town in Shinbone, Oklahoma.
It's
like,
yeah, it's a medical melodrama set in the Wild West. It's like ER, but, you know, or House, but in the Wild West in the 60s.
This makes me think of two other moments in Coen's films. Obviously, there's F Troop on the TV. In A Serious Man, this becomes like a C or a D plot of the show is that F Troop is fuzzy and Arthur Gopnik has to go up on the roof and fix it periodically and mess around with the antenna. Also, Big Lebowski, when Walter and the dude go to...
Oh, I forgot. Brandon.
The house.
That's the other one. Brandon.
The house of the screenwriter of the bulk of the series of Branded. And despite the fact that they're there to interrogate a teenager about the money they think he stole from them, John Goodman's character, Walter, cannot contain his adulation for this guy who's inside of an iron lung. He says, does he still write?
Does he still write?
Oh, no, no. He has health problems.
Uh-huh. Sir, I just want to say that we're both, on a personal level, really enormous fans. Branded, especially the early episodes, was truly a source of inspiration.
Sweetie, sit down. This man is the police.
Oh, no, ma'am. We didn't want to give the impression that we were police exactly. We're hoping it won't be necessary to call the police.
Yeah, it feels like very Hail Caesar, like the Lazy Old Moon section in Hail Caesar. Like there's a subgenre that was specific to a decade. And they're figuring out a way to revive it and do their version of it.
Yeah, it's like you've seen Westerns. Now let's do singing Westerns. Now let's do medical drama Westerns. And this is one of those pieces of ephemera that some people remember. And that's kind of like the sort of nostalgic heart of this piece.
And the end result of it, I mean, it reminds me of Serious Man, also the scene where he's up on the roof and you're hearing everything come through the antenna. And there's this bleeding of different sound sources. Sometimes some of it's TV, some of it's music, some of it's like what else is mixed in there?
Oh,
This play gives you a similar end feeling as a listener, though. I am hearing everything.
Yes.
I hear all sounds and all thoughts simultaneously, and it's all pouring through me.
Yeah, and the idea of a broadcast, like it broadcasts broadly across the United States,
Somewhere
in Vermont on a fire tower, and he's also watching Sawbones. And that's basically the setup for like where we are in Act One.
So let's go through it act by act. Yeah. We begin with a musical overture, sad woodwinds come in, then piano, guitar, mouth harp, leading us into a proper theme song.
Yes.
It opens with very vibey, Carter Burwell, evocative, spooky Fargo type stuff.
I would say these are the two modes of Carter Burwell, maybe. Like in like the most broadest strokes, you've got like the highly emotional, kind of sparse scoring.
Yeah.
And then you've got the genre stuff. So we start with the scoring, which sort of feels like an intro to the whole evening.
Yeah.
It also recalls like some of the more emotional stuff we're going to hear later when things get emotional, like the incidental music that we're going to hear. And then we get to this big booming theme, which in my mind is the theme song. Like when I hear that, I'm seeing the title Sawbones with a very specific font. I can like see a illustration of a saw maybe like forming one of the letters. Like maybe the B is like a saw. The O is like a horse or something. I don't know. and I see the actors' names. Like I see whatever Philip Seymour Hoffman's actor name is.
Yeah. So basically there's this intro that feels like two pieces of music, this kind of evocative, haunting Carter Burwell film score music, then a kind of like in quotations theme song. And then the narrator is bringing us in, saying last time on Sawbones, and bringing us into this serialized narrative. So we drop in on the beginning of a duel.
Yeah.
Between Sawbones, the doctor, and the coward Frank McCready.
The coward Frank McCready, a ne'er-do-well in the town of Shinbone, who doesn't like Sawbones' citified ways. He's like a guy who moved there from the city to try to help with the livestock.
Yeah. So the first scene is basically like a tougher guy, a less educated guy, throwing Sawbones a gun and saying, you have to duel me. And Sawbones is saying, I don't want to fight. I'm a man of science. Man of science, he ain't nothing but a dang horse doctor putting on airs. Which turns out to be true.
Right after he says that, ding dong, center channel. For the first time, we hear something else besides this Western show. We hear a doorbell ring and a door creak. So we've got the setup for a duel. And then at that exact moment, we actually have dueling narrative threads.
Yeah.
A character named Dale, who rings the doorbell and is answered by Mrs. Nelson. Dale was played by John Slattery, and Mrs. Nelson is played by Brooke Smith,
from who you might know from Silence of the Lambs as the senator's daughter.
The senator's daughter who is kidnapped and held in a pit.
Yeah. The American girl with the curly hair.
Yeah. So Dale, John Slattery, shows up and is asking Mrs. Nelson if she is ready for the winds of change. And it turns out he's a door-to-door salesman from the Electrolux vacuum company. And he's going to show her how the vacuum works by putting dirt on her floor. And I just think it's interesting that this scene is the kind of inevitable literal countdown to a duel between two Western gunfighters, or one gunfighter and a doctor who says he's unarmed. To me feels like a duel of like the suburban experience of like somebody shows up to your door. They want to come in. They want to give you a demo of their product.
You have some special technique?
Pick up that shooting iron.
Excuse me?
For sprinkling dirt.
I'm going to count to 10.
No, that was not the demonstration.
Oh.
One.
I am a door-to-door salesman.
Ah.
Two.
Of vacuum cleaners.
Ah.
Three.
The Electrolux wind.
I see.
Four.
A weather front on wheels.
Five.
This is so pointless, McCready.
It doesn't blow. It sucks.
Pointless?
The wind runs on AC.
I tell you what's pointless.
The alternator.
Alternating?
Alternating current.
Where was I? Six.
Do you have an outlet?
Seven.
Ah, there it is.
Eight.
One touch retractable power cord.
We don't have to do this, MacReady.
Nine!
But you unplugged
the tele... I'll plug it in again after the demonstration.
MacReady is counting down. Dale is doing the demonstration. As he's doing the demonstration, Dale and Miss Nelson are pulling together. So there's a countdown and an affair at this beginning in the sequence. That's the kind of, they're meshing those two things.
Do you think that there's already like a vibe there?
They're leading up to hooking up. It's like a, you know, it's a classic 1950s milkman, postman always rings twice. Guy comes over to do a job and hooks up with a housewife by herself, combined with a countdown of a duel that is playing on TV in the room where that's happening.
And that at the exact moment that the duel is going to happen, the door-to-door salesman, Dale, unplugs the television to plug in the vacuum cleaner.
He has to unplug the TV in order to plug in the vacuum cleaner, at which point the sound cuts out on the show in the suburban home.
I feel like Jerry comes in a few lines after the TV gets plugged in. And MacReady somehow has been injured in this duel.
We've jumped forward a little bit in the show. Basically, he has to save the guy that he just shot.
Oh, help me. I was only teasing.
I'm going to need boiling water, plenty of clean towels, and a pint of rye whiskey.
Well, he can't drink. He's gut shot, Sawbones.
The whiskey's for me, damn it. Quick!
This is Tower 18 looking at Sector 2, grid 43, 9 degrees north-northwest. Very faint plume of smoke.
Okay, are we ready?
Roger that, it could be of industrial origin.
The story of the first act is Sawbones doesn't want to shoot this guy, is forced to shoot him, is asked to save his life, drinks some whiskey, opens him up, realizes that he only knows what the inside of a horse looks like, and so just makes his stomach look like a horse's stomach.
Like a ruminating animal's stomach, because like cows have five stomachs, so they like, they're able to digest grass because they like eat the grass, then throw it up a little bit and re-swallow it into a different stomach where it gets sort of systematically digested. I think this is really funny just as a concept, because the joke of one of the of this, of like a more straight medical drama, is he's the veterinary surgeon who steps up and learns how to operate on people. But instead, he's so specific to what he does that he's basically inventing a surgery that converts a human into a cow.
Yeah.
Like he gives him a ruminating digestive system. So it's like he's both so incompetent that he doesn't know how to translate his skills, but then he's also so like supernaturally capable that he does a surgery on somebody that like has never existed and will never exist.
Yeah. That's the plot line of Act One on the TV show. Meanwhile, what's happening, basically, when the TV show comes back on, instead of hearing what's going on in the suburban home washing Sawbones, we instead start hearing a fire tower in New Hampshire.
We hear a new voice in the right channel, in our right ear, John Goodman's voice, very recognizable. And he says, "This is Tower 18 looking at Sector 2, grid 43, 9 degrees north-northwest, very faint plume of smoke." We talk a lot on the show about how something the Coens like to do is cutting between three different simultaneous plot threads.
A braided narrative.
A braided narrative, a three-stranded braid. And John Goodman, in our right ear, is the third rope, the third strand in the braid. He is Mrs. Nelson's husband. He is
Jerry.
He is not home with her. He is up working for the Forestry Service in New Hampshire or Vermont, somewhere in New England, looking out at Lake Winnipesaukee. You were saying this is like a Jack Kerouac novel, right?
Well, just there's these books like Desolation Angels and Dharma Bums for Jack Kerouac. That was like the job that he would get. It was like when he wasn't doing Merchant Marine stuff, it's like go be a fire watch guy on top of a mountain and you can spend an entire summer by yourself meditating with dogs.
And watching for plumes of smoke.
Exactly.
Trying to prevent forest fires.
Yeah.
While that's happening, what's happening back home in Philadelphia?
They're hooking up. And this is, I feel if this was a stage play, the scene where he's demonstrating the vacuum for her would have blocking that would show that even though they're talking about the dirt on the floor and everything, that they are instantly physically drawn towards each other. But in this, it's a total surprise to the experimental medical surgery starts on the TV show, and Steve Buscemi's MacReady character starts screaming as they're operating on him without anesthesia. That starts to bleed in with the sounds of Mrs. Nelson and Dale having sex. It goes, ah, ooh, and then ah. That's like what the script goes.
They're braided together. Yeah, their pleasure and Buscemi's sublime physical pain of being operated on without anesthesia is all happening at once.
There's only a couple moments where it literally just goes one line on each strand of the braid.
And Jerry Nelson is up on a fire watch, thinks he sees smoke, but decides to call home. And the phone rings. Dale says, "Don't you have an answering machine? We carry them." Then the answering machine picks up. And now we are seeing, we hear the answering machine message. "It's the Nelsons. We're busy right now. Please leave a message." So she's having sex with Dale while he's talking to her. But he can't hear what's happening because it's an answering machine message.
It seems like they're playing games with, like, what are sounds that would be playing in a room where two people are starting an affair. So it's like the TV is playing in that room. But also the answering machine is another piece of diegetic sound. So to make a radio play where all the voices that you would hear in a room are happening, but because you can't see it, everything's equalized in a way. Like, that wouldn't be if you're looking at it with your eyes and you're clearly like, that's on TV, that's on answering machine. But in this situation, it's all kind of together. It's all up front similarly.
You don't have an answering machine? We carry them.
Yes, I think it's on. We have one.
We?
It's the Nelsons. We're busy right now.
So please leave a message.
Hello, darling. It's me. I guess you're busy right now.
Oh, yes.
Watching Sawbones.
Oh, do that again.
Of course, I'm watching it too. But it's not the same watching it without you.
The TV goes one way. The phone call is one way too because she doesn't pick up. So she can hear what he's saying, but he can't hear what's happening in the house. And so, like, it's just interesting that there's two one-way broadcasts that are coming into this house while the marriage is being transgressed, right? It's fucked up that she can hear her husband talking to her, but she doesn't stop having sex and she doesn't pick up his message to talk to him. And then, like, the sort of twisting the knife is he says, "I see a plume of smoke." And she says, "Oh, be careful, Jerry." And then Dale says, "Dale, my name is Dale." But she will still talk to the answering machine as one would talk to characters on a TV show. Good. That's like good writing, right?
You're hearing them orgasming in operation, an Old West operation on TV, and someone leaving a voicemail message saying that they're seeing a fire in the distance, and it's all playing on top of itself. And there's no visuals to help you understand what's going on. So it's extremely dense first listen. That is almost playing with, like, how far can you push this to the point where it almost just becomes like music.
And it's also three different types of drama. There's kind of like the heightened, ridiculous thrills of a Western TV show.
Yeah.
Where, like, no matter how crazy or unrealistic it is, you're still wondering, like, can Sawbones do it? Can he pull through?
Yeah.
And then there's the domestic drama of the suburban house and the
affair.
Affair.
Yeah.
The melodrama. And then there's the
natural disaster.
Natural disaster up in the Northeast that feels very real.
Yeah.
Like, that almost feel like when he's talking about, when he's using these codes and stuff, like, that kind of feels like something we would hear, like a pilot into the White Sea.
It's jargon.
It's jargon. Yeah. Like, it feels like
these are professionals.
He's a professional. It's observed protocol that he's observing and that the writing is observing. And this is all happening simultaneously. For me, it's like I picture a map of the United States in my brain when I listen to this in a way that I wouldn't if I was watching a TV. If I was watching an intercut movie, or if I was even watching a split screen movie, I would be focusing on what is happening on the screen. But because it's the theater of the new ear and I'm just listening to it, I'm hearing, I feel like I'm specifically thinking about like America, the country. Like I'm thinking about Oklahoma and the Old West. I'm thinking about Philadelphia, which like is where the country started, kind of like where they wrote the Constitution. And then I'm thinking about, I guess, like natural disasters, like what could happen like in this country. But like I'm thinking about it all like as if it takes place on a map as opposed to it taking place like in a film frame. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. It does. You point out the moment where she says, be careful, Jerry, but there's another moment of confusion between when Jerry is calling in the fire to his superior. There's another blood-curdling scream from Steve Buscemi playing Frank McCready that is playing on the TV in the fire tower.
Jim, it's Jerry, Tower 18.
Well, don't tell him I told.
This thing is no inversion. This thing over Winnipesaukee. It's fire.
That bullet's yearned.
Basin!
Of course I'm sure.
Now let me just...
I am calm. That's the coward, Frank McCready. That's right, I'm watching Sawbones.
The fire that Jerry is observing from the fire tower gets totally out of control and overtakes his position. Like, he burns up at the end of Act 1. So it ends with Jerry screaming about the flames and McCready screaming as he's being operated on. So it's the same McCready sounds, but was previously enmeshed with the sex sounds, is now enmeshed with a person being burned alive. So basically, everything escalates. It builds and builds. Jerry's on fire. McCready's being operated on. We cut to silence, and then a vacuum roars.
Yeah.
And I believe there's a big time ellipse, because when we come back, we're hearing the sounds of Jerry and Mrs. Nelson. He goes, 1 o'clock. She goes, what? He goes, almost 1 o'clock. She goes, oh, good, Sawbones.
She's using the vacuum cleaner that was sold to her by the door-to-door salesman. Jerry's at home.
And no longer in the fire.
No tower. Longer in the fire. We don't necessarily know what has happened to him. There's no special effects makeup. But we do know he went through this experience, this horrible experience. And I guess we know she kept the vacuum. And he's basically telling her, plug the TV in.
Because we know you can't run both at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then we get another musical interlude.
It sounds like basically the theme song part of the overture we heard again. The timing of it really, there's no script for this. We're just listening to the recording and piecing together what's going on. But this is one moment where it really feels like he's saying it's 1 o'clock, Sawbones is on, and we hear the theme song starting as if she has turned on the TV.
Yeah, clearly some time has passed.
Yeah.
And we also have the passage of time in the form of an episode where a bunch of stuff has happened in the intervening time. We could assume that what we heard at the beginning of the play was the season premiere of Sawbones or something like that, or episode 2. And now what we're hearing, now what we're seeing is Frank McCready has started to reform. He's in a schoolhouse. This is something that happens a lot on TV shows, I think, where like the initial villain ends up, like I'm thinking of Sawyer on Lost, like the initial yeah. villain ends up becoming an ally and sort of softening out over the course of the series. And that's the case for Frank McCready. He's in school with a bunch of little kids. He's being taught.
Well, we start off with Sawbones with the rose. He's got a desert rose, and he's going to go into the schoolhouse because he's in love with the school marm.
That is a fine specimen of the desert rose.
Ficus at the campus. I hope it's a worthy offering. I'm bringing it to Miss Barley. I'm going to ask for her hand in marriage.
Good luck, Sawbones.
The person he's wooing is teaching the guy that he shot and built a cow stomach for.
Miss Barley, played by Marcia Gay Harden, is the object of Sawbones' affections. But she's getting her attention monopolized by this like weird half-man, half-cow man-child who keeps, played by Buscemi, who's like belching up he's chewing his cud, and I guess somehow she's kind of enamored of it.
While this is going on, we're listening to Jerry, now blind Jerry, and Miss Nelson watching the show, and he keeps asking her what's happening, and she is describing it, the events on TV, which is a great, if you're just thinking about things that work well for radio play, have a blind character in a radio play where people are watching TV, having a blind character provides a reason for one character to describe the visuals that are happening on screen, which is basically what we're cutting back and forth between Sawbones, the TV show, and Blind Jerry sitting there drinking coffee with Mrs. Nelson and her describing what's happening on screen and pouring coffee for Jerry.
And they're sort of describing a slow dialogue-free scene where Sawbones is giving her a flower and trying to get her to be his gal.
He takes her to Vivaldi Canyon and gives her a desert rose. Yeah.
Valverde? Yeah, which is a fictional location that has been used throughout TV and film history. I think it was originated by the writer of Commando.
Miss Barley? Constance?
Need a refill?
I don't know.
Yes, Varlin.
You're near the bottom.
Yeah. What's happening?
He's down on his... I'm sorry.
What happened?
Spilled a little.
Constance, I've never made a secret of my feelings for you. If there's any way you could reciprocate those feelings...
He's handing her a rose, a ficus ipa.
I would be the happiest man in Shinbone in the whole Oklahoma territory.
Oh!
What happened?
Sawbones tried to kiss the girl, but she turned her head away. She's troubled.
Am I near the coffee?
Varlin, you know I'm so very fond of you. You have been such a dear and true friend.
Oh, Sawbones.
But my heart belongs to another.
Oh.
What's happening?
Sawbones is gazing off.
I understand.
I'm going to marry Frank McCready.
Oh!
McCready!
And this is this is a beautiful scene. There's something, the Brooksmith performance specifically is so melodic and so heartfelt.
Yeah.
And the repetition of John Goodman as Jerry saying, what's happening? What happened? What's happening? You know, this is Sawbones professing his love, asking her to marry him, and she looks away and says she's in love with someone else. And basically, it's landing on Mrs. Nelson, I feel like, in a big way. Like,
yeah.
The scene is about someone watching something on TV and it crushing them in a way that's surprising even to them.
It's resonating so well with her that she can speak in stage directions. Like, she's better at describing what's happening on screen in Sawbones than the narrator, I think. Like, the narrator is kind of just like, when we last left him, like, here's all this stuff that's happening in the episode. But Mrs. Nelson is able to get at the, like, subtle emotional beats of a scene without dialogue.
And she seems to feel terrible for what's happening to Sawbones.
Yeah.
Like, she's crushed for him in a way that makes me think that she's seeing something about her own life reflected back to her.
She didn't end up with the one she wanted. Or there's something about her life that's not satisfying.
Seeing someone not get what they want.
Yeah.
Is just shattering.
Yeah, I think that's really the heart of this, the heart of the story right here is her describing this. She's sort of converting the schmaltz of the Western TV show into the poignant melodrama of her life. Through the way that she's describing this to her husband who had a terrible accident and you know, she has to describe what's happening on the TV to him.
You know, this whole theater piece exists as a jumping off point for Carter Burrell to write music for. And there's an amazing moment right after she says, Varlin, you know, I'm so very fond of you. You have always been such a dear and true friend. At the moment that you anticipate her dropping him, the music just drops out. And we go to silence for a second. And John Goodman's performance, when he asks what's happening, sounds much more uneasy than before. And so in the space between her saying, you know, clearly, like, I'm going to friend zone you, and her saying, I'm going to marry Frank McCready, there's just this incredible use of lack of soundtrack, music soundtrack.
One thing that's interesting about that, too, though, that I hadn't fully clocked is... Jerry and Mrs. Nelson harmonize their O and actually sync up in that moment.
Oh, yeah.
It's like the only time we see them sync up, hear them sync up, is their enjoyment of the show. It's the only thing that holds them together.
They both get it.
Yeah.
When she says she's going to marry McCready, Sawbones' reaction is, you know, to to dig on him because he has the stomach. He goes, he's practically an animal. He actually chews his own cud. This is only because of what Sawbones did.
So that's funny, yeah.
It is just funny. Sawbones is this like heroic, romantic guy, but another reading of the story is very much like he's out of control and bad at what he does and is blaming everyone for things he's done.
Yeah, or he did it as like some kind of weird repressed revenge. Like, oh, I'm this nice guy, but I'm also going to give you this insane medical situation.
But also, yeah, just it's funny to have like a vet who's like, that guy's an animal. You know, you would imagine that a vet would respect.
Yeah, him. Would love animals.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So then the doorbell rings. Jerry says, I'll get it. Miss Nelson says, no, no, dear, stay where you are. And he says, no, no, no. I have to get used to these things. We have no idea what he's talking about. But then we start hearing these metal clunking sounds, eventually revealed how bad his situation is and the fact that we can't see his injuries because it's a radio play. This is all teased out. They're basically slow revealing everything that's happened to Jerry.
And he's talking to Dale. He's talking to John Slattery, the guy who slept with his wife.
Right. He answers the door. Dale from the first scene is back. Dale is shocked by Jerry's appearance and keeps just saying, oh no, what happened to you? What happened to you? This piano part starts that sounds very much like the main theme from Blood Simple to me, like the scene where they're all looking at the ceiling fans and it's cross-cutting between all the characters, kind of the birth of the Braid
yeah.
in the Coen brothers' filmography.
Hello!
Oh my God!
Hello, who's there?
What happened to you?
I was in a fire. Who are you?
Never mind. My God.
Save your pity, whoever you are. I'm fine. My retinas were burned. What's your business here?
Just your retinas?
Then the vitreous humor boiled away.
Oh, Lord.
My leg was crushed by a flaming cockless fur.
Good God.
I'm still getting used to the titanium foot.
And your hand?
Smashed in the ambulance door. Who are you?
I'm with the Electrolux company.
Oh. You're the vacuum cleaner salesman. So you're the cad who made a pass at my wife.
We talked to our friend of the show, Dan Romer. There's a part of the Blood Simple score that uses the Picardy third.
Yes, the Picardy third.
A very Trent Reznor. He says Trent Reznor uses this Picardy third. We're going to play this. It's just this oddly sweet sounding minor chord, basically, right?
It's a minor chord sequence that ends on a major chord instead of a minor.
Yeah.
This was also used on The Next Generation when Captain Picard got his legs cut off. That's why it was called the Picardy third.
But so it's like very, very cool music starts and we're revealing just like my leg was crushed. I'm getting used to my titanium foot. And he goes, and your hand smashed in the ambulance door. Who are you?
Yeah, he also says it was crushed by a
Douglas fir.
Crushed by a Douglas fir, yeah. Insult to injury for this guy. Like, he crushed his hand not from the fire, but just like they were getting him into the ambulance and there was another injury.
It's like when they're rescuing Homer from the gorge. And
I was about to bring that exact example up of Homer getting dropped off the helicopter. It's a very Homer Simpson setup in general. Like, you could imagine an episode of The Simpsons where Homer had to do a fire watch.
This whole Picardy third piano thing, it ends when Dale says, I am with the, when he finally answers the question, says, I'm with the Electrolux company, at which Jerry just goes immediately into like, you're the cad who made a pass in my wife. So he knows about something. But this is our first inkling that Jerry knows what's been going on when he's been out of town and proceeds to just these body thud on the floor sound effect. Titanium, just the Foley artist. We haven't mentioned too, the Foley artist is Marco Costanzo, who's the Foley artist who did their movies.
He's the Coen's Foley artist.
Yeah. So he's on stage in between the orchestra and the actors and Carter.
He must have had assistants too, because you've got to be doing sound effects for three stories at once, right? That's a tough, tough job to get all those things ready.
Marco starts going nuts, basically doing... I think what's funny about this is it's an unseen action scene that turns into a... But it's also an action scene where one of the characters is blind. So doesn't understand... It doesn't sound like he's actually landing any blows on Dale.
No, I think he tried to lunge at him and he fell down.
And so everything is just him hitting into stuff while he's lying down.
Yeah, he's like wriggling around or like rolling around or like leaning against the wall.
Okay.
Yeah. This whole scene also reminds me too doesn't this remind you of Goodman's character in Llewyn Davis on the crutches and also just like his vocal performance?
It reminds me of the actual, you know, Big Lebowski on the floor. It reminds me of John Goodman on the floor.
Yeah.
It's just big guys who can't move, who are still in the middle of a fight.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about this sequence too is that we have just dropped the threading. We're totally in Philadelphia now.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing coming from the TV, because everything before we were either threading between the watchtower and TV or threading between the living room and the TV.
That's right. Yeah.
We're not cross-cutting anymore, but it's also, this is the only scene where Dale, Jerry, and Mrs. Nelson, even though they all talk to, they're never in the same room. They're all in the same physical location. Like, they're all at the house in Philadelphia.
Yeah. It does feel like Sawbones gets dropped a little bit. I guess that makes sense, though, because he's at the door. So maybe, like, when he's at the door, we're not by the TV at that point, so that's why we're not hearing it.
Yeah, because
because she says what happened.
Jerry just falls on the floor. Dale gives him his foot back, and then Jerry calls him a creep, and then Dale leaves.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dale, like, did not know that she was married in the first place.
I suppose not. Yeah.
Because he's like, we? Remember when she says, we have an answering machine, and he goes, we? Question mark?
I feel like at that point, he probably knows.
Contextual clues, maybe. Mm-hmm. If you're a door-to-door salesman, you mm-hmm. should be able to, like, know. Okay, so Jerry comes back to the TV after chasing off Dale. And he goes, what did I miss? And she says, well, they rode back to Shinbone together, gazing off in silence. Who was at the door? Vacuum cleaner salesman. And he goes, I told him the same thing I told the encyclopedia salesman. And then it sounds like he knocks over the coffee. And he goes, am I near the coffee? Sawbones' theme song starts up again, plays through in its entirety, back to the narrator. And we open in Act 3, which is just powerhouse. It's just, we've set up all these different pieces in Act 1 and 2, and Act 3 is just this like masterpiece of threading that starts from the very beginning. I think because it starts in letter format.
In the meantime, Sawbones has disappeared. Mrs. Nelson, 1442 Elm Grove Circle, Pleasantville, PA.
Dale, care of sales department, the Electrolux Company, or Winna, PA.
Dear Mrs. Nelson.
Dear Dale.
I hope you don't mind the salutation.
I hope this letter reaches you.
I never learned your first name.
I never learned your last name, and I have no address for you except at your work.
I am no longer with the Electrolux Company. The many disgruntled letters from Mr. Nelson cost me my job.
My husband is home now, as you learned, though he spends more and more of his time at the local tavern.
Bert?
Jerry, what'll it be?
Usual. Did I miss any?
Sawbones? Just started.
And then it occurred to me that the forestry service must have an opening.
Final episode. Beer back?
Oh, yeah.
It starts in three different locations, again, where it's now Dale has switched place with Jerry. So Dale has gotten a job at the Watchtower. Miss Nelson is home. The TV show is on. So those are the three strands. But what's different about this, and I think what sets it off as like a powerhouse, you're feeling the escalation in Act 3, is that even though Dale and Miss Nelson are in separate locations, they're directly talking to each other. And they're talking to each other through letters, one of which is received and one of which is not received. So they're having a conversation where he can't hear what she's saying, she can hear what he's saying, but because of the way that they're edited together, it sounds like they're answering each other's questions.
You think she got the letter? I feel like they're both writing letters to each other simultaneously, to me.
I think they're both writing letters simultaneously. Yeah. I think his letter to her will get to her because he's sending it to her address.
Yeah.
I don't think her letter to him is going to get to him because...
She sent it to the vacuum cleaner company.
She has no real address for him.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, is like we start this Act 3 on the narrator and then we immediately hear Dale... in the far right channel, which should ring some alarm bells if you're listening closely in terms of like, where is he? Why would he be there? We learned that he lost his job at the vacuum cleaner company
yeah.
because Jerry Nelson was pestering the company with complaints, which kind of reminds me of Cy Abelman in Serious Man sending all the letters to the tenure committee. Yeah. Like, I'm just going to fuck this guy's life up.
It is amazing to imagine Jerry pulling off from that interaction, figuring out who Dale is and being able to follow through with his boss. But yeah, so Dale has lost his job. He has switched places with Jerry, but Jerry's not at home. We've opened up a new location.
Yes, we get a new location, which is at the tavern.
The bar. With Bart the bartender.
Yeah.
It's played by Steve Buscemi.
Steve Buscemi plays the tavern owner as well.
And for me, at that moment, it just sounds like Monsters, Inc.
Because it's John Goodman talking to Steve Buscemi.
Yeah.
Who does Steve Buscemi play in Monsters, Inc.?
The bad guy.
The bad guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also because of the, like, want to have another one? Because, like, all the jokes in Monsters, Inc. are that cadence of, like, it's my job. I'm commuting. You know? So Dale has almost, like, taken this, like, Dale's on another spiritual plane at this point.
I was about to say that. Yeah. He's on a quest. He's on some kind of a spiritual quest.
Something about Dale has been rocked, and now he, having lost his job, is, like, almost as some kind of penance or a way of going deeper, has taken this job as a fire tower watchman.
This is like kind of a trope in movies, like going to the place or taking the job, like taking the role of your nemesis or of your rival.
Everything's been burned to the ground, and he's just talking about, like, I'm watching the seedlings grow in this, like, wrecked out, like, demolished place. And he seems to be spiritually connecting with that process on a deep level of just kind of understanding, like, damage that is done,
yeah,
and how nature grows back from it. Simultaneously to all this, what's happening on the TV show is that Sawbones has gone missing. MacReady has graduated from the schoolhouse and is now doing a correspondence course to become a lawyer, and no one can find Sawbones. Is basically depressed, and now he's missing. His body has been found, and they're bringing him back. He was out in the spot where he proposed to Miss Barley, picking the same flowers that he offered her when he proposed to her, and didn't realize that there was a herd of buffalo coming through, and so lost in his kind of introspective melancholy funk that he got run over. And now the townspeople are looking at his body and talking about all the great things that he did to protect them.
These feel like recaps of episodes that we've seen over the course of a season. Like, you have Philip Seymour Hoffman playing like a little Mexican kid saying he operated on my stuffed animal as if it was a real animal.
This is like the last episode of Mandalorian where all the characters come back who you met. He had to solve a little thing for each one of them, and they all come back in the final. Because this is the finale. That's when Jerry's in the bar, he goes, Bart the bartender says, final episode, beer back.
And Jerry says, oh yeah.
Oh yeah. So this is the culmination, and it's the series finale. Because Sawbones is dead.
Which means viewership was not very good of this show. Like, I feel like there's something funny about all of the narrative aspects of this show being dictated by its format. Like, this character died because the show got canceled. They'll make as many episodes of Sawbones as is ordered by the TV network. And in this case, they didn't order any more episodes. So Sawbones got run over by a bunch of buffalo. I mean, sometimes the main character keeps going because they want to keep room open for like a spinoff or something.
I was reading today about 60s Western TV shows, and there was one that was just a remake of Gilligan's Island called like Curly's Trail or something with the guy that played Gilligan. It was basically like, we're just doing Gilligan's Island in the Wild West.
In the Wild West. I mean, you got to try it.
Yeah.
Golden Girls had one season where they ran the motel.
Yeah. Hurwitz season, right? Mitch Hurwitz and Don Cheadle.
He did that. He did the hotel spinoff.
I think so.
Yeah. What was it called? Like the Golden Hotel. So we've got two longing letters. One of them written by Dale. One of them written by Mrs. Nelson.
Even though they're not actually in dialogue with each other, the parts where they, like when he says, I can't remember all the things we did in front of the television. And she says, I can't forget all the things we did in front of the television. It's like they're talking to each other, even though they're apart.
But we're kind of at this ecstatic, transcendent moment in the story where we're ready to see stuff like that happen, I think.
If you just take out Dale's lines, like I highlighted all of the script basically on like which the three locations. So here I am, Tower 18, gazing out at the same stretch of forest that for so many years your husband surveyed. Seedlings have been planted amid the smoldering stumps. Time, patient time, begins its healing. I can't remember all the things we did in front of the television, but I think it's best now we try to forget. I have gone door to door looking for love, but the thing I found was not love. Love abides. It does not travel door to door. You must comfort your husband now. You must mend what has been broken. We have but one love. However we change, in the end, love endures. Does that make it clearer or harder to understand?
No, it makes it clear that he's telling her that he's saying goodbye and telling her that she needs to move on with her life.
Okay, but so can I read what she said?
Yeah, yeah.
I can't forget all the things we did in front of the television. Dale, I think of you every day. And though there have been other traveling salesmen, other milkmen, pizza boys, and tennis pros, meter readers, mailmen, exterminators, and Jehovah's Witnesses, with you it was different.
Yeah.
You changed me, Dale. You changed me inside. I am ready now for one love. Wherever you are, I need you, Dale. I need you, Dale. I need you, Dale.
And was this not the theater piece that changed Ethan Coen and set him on the course to write one-act plays? This play was the proverbial Dale for the future of Coen's theater.
And it's because at this point, Joel breaks off and it's just Ethan has an affair with the theater.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and what's going on through this build at the end on the TV is that everyone is saying farewell to Sawbones, but then it gets into MacReady giving this speech about his life and how he's just risen and risen and risen to become the governor and is now famous as the governor with the bicameral gut. I've been granted the esteem of men and the love of a good woman.
This is the moment in a cut short, in a show that was cut short, where the slightly disgruntled writer or very disgruntled writer tells you all the things that were going to happen in seasons 3 and 4 and 5. Like, this is the entire arc. This is the entire arc of MacReady, Cud MacReady, as he rises through the ranks and the show becomes a show about Old West politics and, like, he does his version of The Wire. Maybe it's the pitch for the spinoff, actually.
I mean, what's amazing about it is it's just going upwards and upwards and upwards. It's so triumphant. And I mean, if you just look at, like, I have showing Jordan, like, the last page here. It was only when they were having sex before that it was really just cutting back and back and like when, you know, that was the only scene where you were line by line going back and forth.
Like I'm seeing blue highlighter, yellow highlighter, orange highlighter, blue highlighter, yellow. Like it's like teeth in a gear kind of. Yeah.
At the very end, we're going as fast as possible. And it's the most symphonic that this gets. MacReady's speech is going upwards and upwards and Dale is moving away. Every time it cuts between them, they're sweeping in opposite directions, satisfyingly complementary or like counter-complementary directions from each other.
Yeah, well, but also they want different things. It seems like she's basically saying, like, come back to me.
This is so emotional.
The last
2 minutes of this especially are like emotionally overwhelming to listen to. It reminds me of the end of Serious Man.
Yeah.
The way that it just builds and builds and builds in intensity and just kind of peaks out, you know, with a kind of a like a thunderclap, basically. And I think it's their braiding structure that they employ throughout all their movies that starts with that sequence in Blood Simple, kind of just hitting a purely melodic because there's no visuals. It's just sound.
So here I am, Tower 18, gazing out at the same stretch of forest that for so many years your husband surveyed.
Have you heard? They done found Sawbones. They're bringing him in.
Seedlings have been planted amid the smoldering stumps.
Oh, Lord. Lowering down.
Sawbones. Time, patient time, begins its healing.
He was out old Valverde way in the canyon there. Can't figure how he didn't hear the bull buffalo. What trampled him down.
Valverde, what incarnation was he doing there?
I can't remember all the things we did in front of the television.
I can't forget all the things we did in front of the television.
Oh. Let us gather round his poor battered body.
Well, what's that he's holding?
Figures at the campus.
A desert rose.
But I think it's best now we try to forget.
Why, he is picking flowers.
Sawbones was a good man.
I have gone door to door looking for love.
Well, he rode out to my place Christmas Eve when my paint mare was full and stayed with her all night.
But the thing I found was not love.
He treat my little curse pit bunny wang. He was sick, just like he was a working draft animal.
Love abides. It does not travel door to door.
And you all know how when Sawbones shot me, he opened me up and saved my gut.
Oh, he sure didn't save them right up.
Fashioned two good stomachs out of the ruined one.
You must comfort your husband now.
Save my life, he did. If the first stomach can't handle my chow, I can herp her up, shoe it over, and send her back down.
Wish I could do that just like old Bossy.
You must mend what has been broken.
Goodbye, Sawbones.
Adios, Senor Sawbones.
Farewell, Sawbones. Farewell.
Dale, I think of you every day.
Yes, I married Constance Barley, and in the fullness of time, I received the honors of this world.
Another double.
And though there have been other traveling salesmen...
I rose! How I rose!
Other milkmen, pizza boys, and tennis pros...
I became a lawyer!
Meter readers...
Legislator...
Mailmen...
And finally...
Exterminators and Jehovah's Witnesses...
Governor of the Oklahoma Territory!
With you it was different.
I became known as the Great Ruminator!
You changed me, Dale!
Cud McCready!
You changed me inside!
The governor with the bicameral gut!
We each have but one love.
Yes! Esteem of men.
I am ready now for one love.
And the love of a good woman.
However we change.
Never a one deserved it more, though.
Wherever you are.
And the man we call.
In the end.
Sawbones.
Love endures.
I need you, Dale.
Sawbones.
Love endures.
I need you, Dale.
Sawbones.
Love endures.
I need you, Dale.
Sawbones.
What a load of crap.
So, Carter Burwell... He was talking about that there's a sequence in the middle of Blood Simple where Fran McDormand is lying in bed and John Getz is lying in bed and Dan Hedaya is leaning back in his chair at the roadhouse and they're all staring at the ceiling. And they just start to, this piano theme that sounds very much like the piano that was playing when Dale came to the door and was talking to Jerry. This piano theme starts playing and the editing and the piano theme ties together the characters and also does these handoffs from the characters. We're suddenly cutting from the expression on one of them while they're looking right and then cutting from Fran McDormand looking left with a certain emotional expression to Dan Hedaya in a different place looking right is almost as if he's catching her emotional energy. It becomes like a dialogue scene.
Something that I noticed that I had never caught is there's the sort of tricksy fake eyeline match where Dan Hedaya is looking up and then we see the ceiling fan, which we think is his POV, and then it pans down to Frances McDormand in bed. So we realize, so we've skipped locations, through the cut, we've cut locations. But so again, it's like the locations get tied together.
A quote from the Blood Simple Criterion Collection doc with Carter and Skip. He's talking about how the score started out more electronic and abstract and became more piano, organic, and emotionally driven.
Yeah.
And he goes, it's a metamorphosis that we've experienced in a number of films because if you ask me, they don't typically write with the idea of emotion and human warmth being one of the most important features of their screenplays. It comes up sometimes, but it often happens because a particular actor like Fran will inject it. We began to realize when we were recording the score that the piano brought the characters together in a way. It created human relationships in a way that I don't think any of us actually anticipated. Carter basically talking about when they were putting the music on that scene for the first time, that it like suggested an emotional content to the film that was never like a part of the planning process. And that this had repeated itself on a lot of other projects where the Coens kind of in their plan making are not really thinking about where is the emotional bleed moments going to come from.
Mm-hmm.
But it's more once you have the actors actually running through the actions described in the script, you suddenly see that there's an emotional like live wire event happening. And then using music to tie together different live wire moments with editing and music to make it like, oh, this is what the film is about. Their films are so plot-driven and so tension-driven.
Yeah.
And then there's these moments of emotional and spiritual, just kind of overwhelming. It's that feeling you have when you're watching a Coen Brothers film where it's not just exciting, it's not just hard-boiled, but it's like transcendent or haunting in some strange way. It becomes emotionally deep and resonant in a way that sneaks up on you because yeah. you're mostly just watching like something really tightly paced or something with really great jokes and really great sense of place. It's like when you're watching Miller's Crossing and suddenly you're like, why is this the most beautiful thing ever? And I think what Carter is saying in this is that those moments are not written in. They appear like through a process of shooting the scenes, throwing those characters to actual actors. And then what has often happened in the, he's saying it's repeated that they start out abstract and then start to be like, well, this look that someone's giving is actually quite emotional. And if we can bridge it with music to this other scene where someone is giving an intense look, all of a sudden it's a relationship between these two threads of the braid.
Yeah. They're all having emotions that connect to each other as opposed to they're all having their own private moments that are just being intercut. It's like this larger transcendent emotional matrix between the characters. And I also want to note that as you're describing this so eloquently, the skies have opened up and the rain has been pattering against the window frame.
We're like, fully now inside like a car going through a LA style car wash.
I just think it's great that right at the moment when you're talking about this transcendent experience, that the skies opened up and rain started pattering against the windows. It felt like it was happening in the moment.
I don't know. I'm just trying. I feel like Sawbones is this strip. It's both very elaborate and very stripped down. And it's just experimenting with how strong this central thing that they all discovered working on the first movie together is. That with just great meaning and emotion and poignance grows out of creating a braid and then connecting it with music and allowing the actors to really inhabit it to the full emotional, like, nth degree, which I feel is the performances here. This cast is incredible, and they're giving incredible, incredibly deep, heartfelt performances.
Yeah, I can't. I don't even know what to add. You hit the nail on the head.
The reason why it also feels like a test of that is because it's so silly. What they're doing is so silly, and I am still moved to tears by the last 2 minutes of this, and I think it's actually incredibly sincere in a way.
The sincerity is in the connections between them as opposed to like what's happening in any individual scene.
Right. I feel it's like the ultimate example of that thing that Burwell is talking about. Like they have found when they set up these different racetracks and then start braiding them and then start connecting them with sound and editing them so that it almost seems like the different braids are talking to each other in the language that is used for dialogue in movies usually, that deep, deep things that couldn't be planned start to resonate out of it. And like that's what's being done in a kind of tour de force way here.
Three is the magic number. I, when we did our dialectic episode, I was afraid to bring up the idea of trielectics. But I'm bringing it up now. I think that there is truly something geometrically powerful. Like the triangle is the strongest shape, right? Like physically. Like there just is something about like 3 points connected with the lines of narrative and score.
It's like with 3 chords, you can do so much. There are songs that just have 2 chords and they're really good. But with 3 chords, you can really just kind of go endlessly.
Yeah.
And you can see it's like, you just look at the pages, it's like some of the pages are just like yellow and orange. And it's a lot of time of like yellow and orange. And then when it goes to like orange and blue, it feels really good because you're changing it.
Yeah.
And then you go to all yellow, just a couple pages of all yellow. It's like 3-card Monty. You know, it's like when you have a braid, you can, it's the smallest amount of pieces that have infinite variations.
Because you can go longer in one and then longer in another. It's the best way to make an audience not feel like they're seeing the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
Because you can always cut to like the third thing, or you can go longer in one of the things.
It's also, you can basically just cool out threads of the braid. I think that's what I'm trying to say. It's like, you can be like, right now we're just doing thread one and two, which means that everything that's happening in three is just taking some time away to like gain specialness.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Well, a few weeks ago, we saw some of Ryan Chikartin's films in a theater. And that was something that I noticed is like, why am I able to sit here and follow a story where I have no idea what anybody's talking about?
Yeah.
And the cutting is so relentless that if this was an Instagram short, I see so much throwaway content that has a visual style that's kind of similar to that. And like part of it's just that like Ryan Chikartin's a genius and is doing amazing formal stuff. But I think this structural idea of cutting between three different locations is something that I noticed that he was doing like very, very consistently through all the shorts we saw, despite the fact that it was all over the place and it felt like glass was being shattered, you know, like yeah. literally and figuratively, like I was just watching glass be shattered, but also it was very clearly like, there's the people in the van, there's the people in the office, there's this other person in a bedroom, and like they're going through it. And now let's go back to the people in the van. Oh, now the people in the van are outside of a motel and the lighting's really crazy. And now I'm with these two other people and I'm seeing what's going on with them. And like that rhythm, like Chikartin is actually like, it proves the case because the content itself is so, so out there. But there's just something calming about like, oh, I'm going to this and I'm going back to this. And then I have the third thing. I go over here and I go over there.
I think what Carter Burrell is saying is that like this is a strategy where more comes out of it than you put in. That there's power in the timing that makes an audience be able to get real meaning out of something that was just more set in motion rather than pre-planned, right?
Yeah, and it kind of like it almost makes scenes into music too.
Yes.
Because you're thinking about how the scenes relate to each other as opposed to like what is in the scene, which feels very musical to me. Like I'm not a musical person. I can't play music, but like that feels like that's kind of the essence of music is like notes against each other.
Oh yeah. Dan Romer has explained to me many times.
And like notes at the
melody
same time,
is yeah. just the space between the notes. It's not the notes themselves.
I think that's great. I think that's amazing. Just to put a capper on the story is they say Sawbones over and over again. It's an emotional catharsis. And then the ending is Jerry Nelson saying, "What a load of crap," and walking away with his titanium foot. Like just a little bit self-deprecating, obviously. We're having one character just being like, "I don't fuck with this." But that doesn't necessarily mean that the entire point of the play was like, this was stupid.
The first act is Dale and Mrs. Nelson together, and then Jerry is off alone. Then it's like Mrs. Nelson and Jerry and Dale shows up and gets chased off. In the third act, they're all separate, and Sawbones dies. And basically all that happens is the bad guy from the first scene who threw out the gun, made the duel happen, then made him save him, then came back as a cow, and now is the governor. He's who's found true love. It's like the whole arc. Everyone else got totally trashed except for MacReady, basically.
Yeah, he's the only one who came out. Could we say that maybe Dale has a interesting, thoughtful life? I mean, he's sad about but it feels like Dale kind of found some kind of harmony, right?
Yeah, but if Dale just knew that she still loved him, he could be with her. So I actually think it's a tragic ending for Dale. Like he understands love, but he's, at least for the time being, just alone looking at this forest.
Yeah.
I guess she could find him.
She
Sawbones
could.
Sawbones too.
Yeah, Sawbones too. We got to get it going. Theater of the New Year. I don't know if there will be a Sawbones too, but there will definitely be a Coen's Theater Volume 2.
Oh, yeah. Coen's Theater Volume 2. Next up is Almost an Evening. Oh, my God. This is like some of the most surreal.
Yeah.
Almost like Matrix Reloaded scenes written by the Coen brothers.
Yeah. I think we should also say that we're not saying that we're pushing pause on the pages. We have plans to go back to the regular.
We're coming back next with episode 30 of the pages. We're beginning.
We're adding strands to the braid.
We're adding strands to the braid.
Yeah. We're going to braid in different types of episodes, including a live episode, which you should come out and see.
Yeah.
On November 15th.
At Life World
at 8 p.m. Check the show notes for the ticket link, as well as the link to the Ko-Fi, join the Discord, and listen to Sawbones on the Being Charlie Kaufman website. We'll have the link to that too. Did we do it?
I think we did it. We will see you next time on To the White Sea.
Sawbones!
Love endures.
To the White Sea is produced by Jordan Fish and Ray Tintori.
Starring Griffin Newman as Lieutenant Muldrow.
Production support provided by Ben Hosley and Ike Sreeskandarajan.
To the White Sea theme music, written and performed by Dan Romer.
Rectify moments of serious energy to fail up in the face of most odious time. Why am I quite much faster than vacuums of words to a century of high-needed passions? What of the grace of the darkness of the subject of fake concern?